Submissions recently closed for Ireland's first draft National Maritime Planning Framework, which is the long-term framework for managing our marine activities and resources. In Westport, the tourism organisation has put forward a submission for a Clew Bay master plan and for a marina for the town. Joanna McNicholas has been to Westport to cast her eyes over the plans.
Clew Bay on the County Mayo coast is similar to a large lake. It measures approximately 10 miles by 7 miles and it has 10 harbours and over 300 islands. Westport Tourism Organisation has a long-term vision for utilising Clew Bay's resources. They also have a plan to develop a marina at Westport Harbour. Chairman of Westport Tourism, Donal O'Shea, told me about the Clew Bay master plan.
It's a much wider plan which takes in all Mayo coast, really, you know, out to Lewisburg and up to Belmullet, etc. It's taken in all those areas and out to Achill. The long-term plan, of course, is to bring out the real features of Mayo and the West and Westport to attract people from all over the world. And Westport has got everything, you know, it's got everything except the marina. And if you look at it, there's no place that yachts can come in apart from Killybegs in the north and Rosseville in the south. I mean, Westport is probably the finest, and I mean, I come from Kerry and Killarney and all that, but it's one of the finest places to come in Ireland. And I feel myself, if we had a marina, we would attract yachts from all over the world.
There is also a proposal to develop a ferry terminal at Westport for summer passenger services to Clare Island and Danish Turk.
We've seen this year the pier at Runa is not operating very well with regard to the winter anyhow. And the idea, if you had a marina here, you could get the boats to come in to directly from Clare Island and Danish Turk into Westport.
A triangular-shaped inlet at Westport Harbour is ideally suited for the proposed marina. Marine consultant Captain Alex Blackwell describes how this site could be transformed into a marina.
First of all, obviously it's silted up and that would need to be dredged or dug out. The big argument against that always is, what do you do with all the stuff you dig up? And in this case, we would follow best practice in countries like Germany and Holland. The idea is to put a bulwark all around the perimeter of the marina. It could be metal, it could be stone, it could be, you know, there's lots of materials you could make it out of, but it would be a vertical or more or less vertical wall, or it could be a sloping wall too if it's stone, and backfill that with what you dig up. The mud would be pumped in behind this, let settle out, and then more mud pumped on top of that to create a good solid base and a good solid piece of land. And again, this is not new, this is nothing that we've dreamt up. This is done all over the world. That would provide new land for all the people living on there, provide a huge amenity, an extension of the Greenway, which is one of the big attractions here in Westport, in the Westport area. People could cycle and walk and everything there. Marina is a huge attraction, so that would lend itself to more tourists coming and more visitors coming to this part of town. It would be basically invisible. It's just that there would be, in cases, there might be 10 meters of land, additional land that didn't exist before. It solidifies very quickly and greens over very quickly because, if you like, the soil that comes out of an area like that is very rich. And you could turn that into an absolutely beautiful parkland.
And then on the inlet where it would actually go out into the main Atlantic there, what would you have there? Would there be some sort of a gate?
There are two options there that we've been discussing. One is a lock like you have in Galway Harbour or down in Kilrush, so that retains a high level of water inside, let's call it a lake. Or you put a sill, which is basically a low wall. The water would then go down at low tide to that level and maintain a few meters of water inside the area. Those are the two options that there are. It might be a combination of the two. There is a natural point where the land closes in from either side already, and closing that off would not be a huge thing. I mean, of course, it's an engineering task, and putting a lock in is fairly involved. It involves a pair of gates so that you can come in through it in two stages. it's been done. It's nothing new. It's very standard technology.
So within the lagoon area, then the lake area, it's proposed to have berths for the boats and also a water sport area.
Absolutely. In fact, it's 40 acres right now. The marina is only going to take up maybe 5 of those, and the rest is all would all be available for, you know, dinghy sailing and swimming and all kinds of other things, because obviously it has to be kept clean, so it's being done. This is something that's being done in Kilrush as well. Right adjacent to the marina is a water park where people play all summer long and with all kinds of, you know, water toys and stuff, you know, bouncy castles and whatever. I have no idea.
And how many berths is it proposed to have there?
Well, initially, we would look at like something like 60, with an expansion up to maybe 200. It all depends on the take-up and the amount of yachting tourists we get coming down this way. As it stands, the level of tourism, marine tourism here, is very, very low. Marine tourism is a huge potential for here. Right now, it's virtually zero. Virtually no boats come this way at all. When we're out sailing, we don't see anybody else. There might be a British boat, or we might see Celtic Mist, the IWDG, the Irish Whale and Dolphin Group boat out there. And that's it, and we're on our own. Foreign boats, not at all. And the reason is there are no facilities here on the West Coast. Right now, there is a marina in Galway. The next one down is Kilrush from there. There is a marina up in Killybegs. And we are a big hole on that chain, and you need a daisy chain. And if we had that, we would get more people sailing the west coast of Ireland, bringing, obviously, tourism dollars or euros into our local economy here. And another reason for having a marina is there are lots and lots of people all over Ireland who would love to have a boat out on Clew Bay. Clew Bay is one of the most spectacular bays in the world.
And what else is needed at the marina, like facility-wise?
Well, facility-wise, you need an office. You need changing facilities, toilets, washing machine. First thing I look for is where to dispose of garbage, where can I wash my clothes, where can I buy groceries, which we have here on the quay? Is there a pub and a restaurant? So we would have to have a fuel dock. We would have to have a pump-out facility because boats do not discharge their sewage anymore. They need to bring that ashore somehow. There would need to be a boatyard kind of an arrangement, a lifting-out facility for boats, because we have a hard stand area there already where boats are being lifted out. That would obviously be increased with the backfill that we've talked about. And if we get what's called a travel lift, we can lift out larger vessels, which would help the fishing community here as well. All the local fishermen have problems lifting out their boats if they need to be inspected. The RNLI could lift out their boat here instead of bringing it up to Killybegs. I mean, you can only imagine how much it costs them to motor up to Killybegs once or twice a year. That's a fortune. And they could just come to Westport, lift out, have their painting done or whatever repair work done, and go back on the water in short order. So there's advantages to all aspects, you know, from the economy to local fishermen to tourism and everything. The use of the marina will be a combination of local boats. Mayo Sailing Club is a large and vibrant club. In fact, it's one of the most active sailing clubs in the country now. With the growing number of boats, we need additional places for them to stay over winter and be hauled out. Fishermen will be using it. Have a facility that you can lift in and lift out a boat at any time of the year would be a huge boon to them. If they need to, you know, do a repair or do something underneath the boat, they can just come in and it can be lifted out. There will be people locally who have little motorboats and stuff and sailboats who don't mind having to wait for the tide to go out on the bay. And of course, tourists, visitors to Westport. That's land-based tourists who might bring a trailerable boat in and leave it in there or keep a boat here permanently in Westport. And then, of course, there are the visiting boats that come from Sweden or Denmark or Germany. And there's a huge fleet of boats. I've been told there's figures of like 40,000 boats in that region. Many of them come as far as Scotland, but never touch Ireland because there's nothing here for them. There's no facilities. I mean, there's Spanish boats that would want to come up. British boats, French boats, all of them. We have lots. There's endless yachts everywhere. And this is such a beautiful cruising ground. It would be fantastic to welcome them here.
The proposed marina will cost in the region of 20 million euros. Here's Donal O'Shea of Westport Tourism.
We're spending 250 million on a road at the moment from Westport to Castlebar. And I think if you compare that with the 20 million for a marina, it'd be buttons towards the road, you know? So 20 million for a marina would be very small money for the outcome that would come from it, and the sales and demands from the extra people coming in, which would create jobs, money, tax for the government. The council just haven't 20 million like that, so we've got to lobby with government at government level. We've got to get money out of Dublin, you see. This is one of the things I find, there's an awful lot of money is cocooned in Dublin.
Based on previous experience, Donal has ideas for a temporary solution.
When I was managing in Clare Island, I got 20 floating moors, and we put them floating off the coast of Clare Island, and it brought in yachts. And you see, the yachts can come in and they can moor, and if they're outside of it, they can come in and they're little dinghies anyhow, you know. It could start straight away, actually, because moorings, you just have them floating and you would link your yacht to it. I think from now on, we'd want to be start the planning for the real marina.
And thanks to Joanna McNicholas on those plans for Westport and County Mayo. Now, lots of us have been watching the new series of Das Boot, the German U-boat drama from World War II, set variously in France, in the Atlantic and in New York. 2 weeks ago, we heard about the kind of people that U-boat commanders were, but one name in particular has come up recently. That was Gunter Preem, known as the Bull of Scapa Flow. Scottish historian Dougie Martindale has written a book about Gunter Preem and U-47. He spoke to me about this U-boat commander, but first, how the original Das Boot series was based on true events, from a book written by a man who had gone on a U-boat in a World War II patrol as a Nazi propagandist.
Derives from the novel in 1973 by Lothar Günther Buchheim. He was a proper propaganda journalist on board the real U-96, and they had a war patrol in, between October and December 1941. And the reason it's so realistic, the original Das Boot film, is because it's based on his experience, because he set the character upon himself in the real war patrol, and the U-boat commander, Heinrich Lehmann Willenbrock, who was a famous U-boat commander, was a consultant on the movie. So
because
that's why,
unlike the movie, he actually survived the war.
He did, yes. He quite a lot of the early aces died in combat, and a very high number of U-boat crewmen died during the war. But Lehmann Willenbrock survived to become a training commander.
Your book is about Gunter Preem. Tell me something about him.
Gunter Preem, very, very famous due to the sinking of the Royal Oak in Scapa Flow in October 1939. They sneaked into the main Home Fleet naval anchorage and sank the British battleship. They became an overnight celebrity and became extremely famous. Then they continued to complete a total of 10 war patrols before he was lost in combat aboard U-47 in March 1941. And that was the month where the three famous aces, Shepka, Kretschmer and Preen, were all lost. So that was a hammer blow to the U-boat Waffe, the U-boat arm.
Getting Scapa Flow is in Scotland, as we know. Now, tell me something about this mission he undertook and how he actually carried it out.
Scapa Flow is a very large anchorage, deep water anchorage that was used to house the Grand Fleet in the First World War. And then at the start of the war, it was the Home Fleet. But it wasn't secure. The British Admiralty hadn't secured the entrances at the start of the war. And the German Luftwaffe flew reconnaissance raids to take photographs, and they determined that they could sneak in through Kirk Sound, which is an entrance to the east side, and there was two gaps between block ships, which were old merchant vessels that were deliberately sunk and anchored to the shore, and that allowed the U-boat U-47 to sneak in. They remained on the surface the whole time. That's one of the things that many people don't really appreciate. They think a U-boat or as a submarine, but actually they're more like submersibles, where there were surface boats that only that could submerse when they needed to. So they actually remained on the surface throughout the entirety of the operation. They sneaked in on the surface past the village of St. Mary's, and then they went around trying to find targets. The problem for them was that the home fleet had been dispersed, so the only capital ship that was left in the anchorage was the Royal Oak. For example, HMS Hood, as you may well know, was the pride of the Royal Navy, and that had been moved to Loch Ewe in the west side of Scotland at the time. So the Royal Oak was the only capital ship that was in, and it was they sunk them in that corner.
There was a huge loss of life.
There was. The traditional figure is 833, but more traditional figures was moved up to 834. And in conducting my research, I think it might be 835 or 836. But a significant number were below the age of 18, were boy sailors. One of whom was 15 years old, a bugler boy, 15 years old.
Preen himself, he became famous in Germany because of this. He went on to have several more patrols. At one stage, he sunk another ship which had a high number of German people on board.
That's correct. That was the Arandora Star, which was a passenger liner pre-war. And that was a great tragedy. That was over 800 people on board, including sort of Germans as well. The really particularly tragic thing was that they'd had a very successful from their point of view patrol, and they were on their way home with one dud per torpedo, which they managed to fix, and they sunk the Arandora Star, and they put up a pennant with 15,501 tons, and they went back to Kiel. And they were on the newsreels sort of celebrating the sinking. They didn't know that they had compatriots on board. At some point they would have become aware.
And what happened when they became aware of this? Did it have an effect on them?
It wasn't known at the time. The German public wouldn't have been known, but I'm sure it would have had a big effect on them. Yes.
Preen himself, this U-boat commander, he was a fairly ruthless personality.
He was aggressive. The Bull of Scapa Flow is what he was called, because his crew thought him as aggressive and like a charging bull within the Scapa Flow. So that's why they painted the emblem, the snorting bull, because they thought he was aggressive. But they all sort of idolised him, his crew, because he got the best out of him. And you can read in the war diaries which he wrote. You can tell that he doesn't accept anything less than professionalism and dedication. So he was very dedicated. U-47 and Günther Preen were together very deadly in terms of sinking 31 ships.
What was his background, and what was the typical background of a U-boat commander?
Well, he was in the merchant marine, but then the economic troubles in the 30s meant he was unemployed, and then there was a training ship in the German pre-war Navy which sank, and the German Navy asked the German merchant Navy for some of their best officers, so that the class of 31/33 was what Günther Preen was part of, and some of his contemporaries that went on to become U-boat aces were also part of that class.
Well, how many patrols did he do?
He did 10 in total. So the first patrol was, you think of the start of the war being the 1st of September, and then ultimately the 3rd of September when Britain and France declared war. But the German U-boats actually went on war patrol earlier than that, then the 19th of August, they had orders, and they painted out the pre-war markings and actually went to take up assigned stations in the Bay of Biscay and the North Atlantic and the Atlantic. So they actually took up a war patrol prior to September. So the Scapa Flow mission was actually their second war patrol as a special mission. So we tend to think of Günther Preen and his second in command, Engelbert Endras, became a very famous U-boat commander as well. We tend to think of them as very veterans, because that's what they became. in actuality, the famous Scapa Flow mission, they were actually quite inexperienced. They never had any depth charge attacks at that point, and they'd only had one war patrol. After that, they had several more war patrols, which were plagued by torpedo failures. Just over 60% of torpedoes were failed. And then the middle of 1940, there was quite a few Wolfpack attacks, and that's one of the things we remember these U-boat aces for attacking the convoys at night, going in on the surface and going in into the convoy and dispatching vessels on the surface.
How long would a patrol last?
They didn't last too long. They could be 2 to 3 weeks. It made a big difference when the Germans had access to the French ports, because U-47 was initially based at Kiel, and then they would have to transit around the North Sea and round the sort of north of Scotland. But when they were based in Lorient, which would be in the summer of 1940, from that point on, they could go straight from Lorient out to attack the convoys. So that narrowed the duration of the patrols, and it meant that they could refit the boats and get them reloaded and get them out to sea faster. So the war patrols, as a result, were slightly shorter.
The U-boats, they had a huge, very, very high mortality rate.
They had a massive mortality rate. It was roughly three quarters. Up till about 1943, the Battle of Atlantic, there was really high losses on either side. But what was known as Black May 1943, and it was Black May from the German point of view, but not from the Allied point of view, was where they lost over 40 boats in that one month, and they had to kind of withdraw for a while from the Atlantic, because the Allies had technological improvements, had much more air cover and much more convoy escorts. The Germans they didn't really recover from that at all, but they had to keep sending out the boats with all the very young crews who were getting more and more inexperienced. So as a result, they were either killed in the first war patrol, or they might last one or two patrols, but they didn't last long. Whereas at the start of the war, the commanders had at least a chance of surviving until they moved on to a training role.
Gunter Preen himself disappeared with his U-boat in 1941 somewhere off the west coast of Ireland.
We don't really know what happened. I don't think we'll ever know. The British destroyer HMS Wolverine was credited with sinking U-47 on the 8th of March 1941. But it was subsequently realised about 20 years ago that it was the German U-boat UA, which was damaged and survived to get back to port, that was attacked on the 8th of March. And I've been in discussions with the grandson of the commander of the destroyer, Captain Roland, who was credited with that. But there's a fair chance that the Wolverine actually did sink U-47, but actually one day previously, on the 7th of March was the day where they lost contact via radio with U-47. So that's when it went missing, not on the 8th. There could have been other issues, like it could have been hit by another torpedo from a German U-boat, or it could have been a mechanical mishap. I don't think we'll ever know.
How are these U-boat commanders depicted now throughout the world and in Germany? I understand lots of them were not Nazis.
Generally speaking, they weren't Nazis. There was a few, as you might expect. They're held in reasonable regard. It maybe doesn't help with films like U-571, which depict the sort of Nazi U-boat commanders. What some people don't realise is that U-47 and Gunter Preen, the first war patrol, they stopped the ships, asked for the crew to go to the lifeboats, and then they gave provisions to the British seamen, and then sank the ship. At the start, there was some sort of gentlemanly conduct.
Your book, The Bull of Scapa Flow, just published last year. Where can we get it?
Amazon's always a good place to get it. I'm not quite sure about other bookshops, given the lockdown, etc. But Amazon, you can get it. It was published by Frontline in the UK, but I think abroad it was Naval Institute Press.
Thanks to Dougie Martindale. And you can find his book, The Bull of Scapa Flow, Galdhøpriggen and U47 on Kindle as well.